Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm joined by Aziz Huq, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He is a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the author of Unchecked and Unbalanced: Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. Aziz Huq has an op-ed in Monday's New York Times called Defend Muslims, Defend America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aziz Huq.
Hi, Ian. It's good to be back. Thank you.
And it is extremely puzzling to figure out this rash of Sharia laws. The very idea is so insulting, as though there's some incredible epidemic that some foreign power is going to infiltrate the America to the extent that they can actually change the laws of the land. It is such a ludicrous and racist and paranoid concept. But it's taking root, and I take it that having passed these laws in Oklahoma, the people that are propagating this nonsense are on a roll.
That's correct. There's an organization called Act for America that has been advocating for and encouraging state legislators to enact rules barring the recognition of Islamic religious law. A first wave of these proposals were introduced in state legislatures and in some cases on state constitutional amendment ballots in 2010. In one case, Oklahoma, the proposal passed. It passed in Oklahoma as a constitutional amendment, although it's now being litigated in federal court. And what we've seen since then is a larger wave of proposals at the state legislative level, almost 20 now, of where the proposal either singles out Islamic law or is written in broader terms concerning foreign or international law, but where the arguments that are made in the public domain and where the sponsors essential concerns relate solely to Muslim law, Islamic law.
Well, Aziz Huq, it was bad enough that President George W. Bush elevated Osama bin Laden as an equal player on the world stage by comparing him to Hitler, and he required the full might of the United States military to finally smoke him out. But bin Laden is dead, and bin Laden is not running around the Midwest calling for Sharia law. I mean, where do they get this idea from? That somehow this foreign law is going to be imposed upon the heartland of America?
Well, that's a great question, and I'm not sure there is a good answer to the question. What we do know is that there was a spike in anti-Muslim feeling in the United States after the 2001 terrorist attacks. Now, that's probably predictable. What's less predictable is that while all of the indices that we have of anti-Muslim bias, so employment discrimination, hate crimes, survey evidence from nationwide surveys, all of those dip in 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006. In the last couple of years, however, they have started to rise again sharply. You're starting to see a lot more employment discrimination, a lot more hate crimes, a lot more self-reporting of animus in national public opinion surveys. And it is against that context that these proposals arise. So it's not clear that the proposals are a response to some factual development on the ground. As you say, there's really no factual development that these proposals are responding to. There's no state that's about to adopt religious law, at least Islamic law. There's no state court or federal court that has to recognize or enforce a law or a rule chosen by a private party if that law or rule violates fundamental public policy. For example, if it's harmful for women or if it's misogynistic or in some way. So it's not the case that these proposals are responding to a real trend. They are responding to this shift, this upswing in negative public sentiment that we've seen over the last couple of years.
Well, Aziz Haq, I just was just critical of President Bush a moment ago because I think his foreign policy was catastrophic, both in Iraq and Afghanistan and in general. But he as a person wasn't prejudiced. He was quite sympathetic to emigration from Mexico, and he was also went out of his way after 9/11 to embrace Islamic leaders and to differentiate Osama bin Laden from Islam, even though, as I said, his basic impulse to elevate this guy was counterintuitive. But something has happened in the intervening years in terms of our political leadership, and I don't know that Obama is stepping up to the plate here, maybe because they accuse him of being a Muslim. He's sensitive about this. But, for example, the other night on the first of what will be, unfortunately, many Republican presidential candidate debates, this pizza fellow, he gets up there and was asked about why he would not have a Muslim in his cabinet. And he made the most ludicrous and racist remarks. And the thing that I found shameful was that none of these Republicans on stage had the dignity to challenge this overt racism from this obviously guy that was, way above, fighting way above his weight or below, whatever the expression is. He shouldn't have been on the stage in the real world, but I guess he sold a lot of pizzas.
I think you're right to say, Ian, that there is a leadership acumen on these issues. I think, as you say, President Bush can be criticized in many ways, but on the question of whether he believed that religious liberty was an interest or a value that all Americans, regardless of their faith, shared, I think there's no question that he not only personally believe that, but spoke to that question in ways that were effective and that had probably something of a disciplining effect on his party. People didn't want to step out of line from the views expressed by the chief executive. By contrast, it's not just that Obama hasn't spoken clearly to these issues. One might argue that his speech a couple of years ago in Cairo was an effort to speak to a Muslim audience, albeit one overseas, it's that he has affirmatively distanced himself from these issues. So no member of the Obama cabinet has visited a Muslim or Islamic religious center or institution in the tenure of his in his tenure in office. In the period of campaigning up to the 2008 election, it's a matter of public record that the Obama campaign took measures to ensure that Muslim contributors, even if they were bundlers, would not appear on a platform with President Obama. And one can understand these measures as responses to a fear on the president's political staff or the then candidate's political staff that these associations would taint Obama. But whatever the reason he might have had or has for those decisions, the fact is that they have left open a vacuum into which people with much more negative views of Muslims and Islam have stepped and have successfully dominated the discussion.
Again, I'm speaking with Aziz Haq, a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He wrote an op-ed in Monday's New York Times called Defend Muslims, Defend America. And I've always thought the as absurd as this war on terror is and has been, the only possible way that such a war could be won would be by nurturing and encouraging moderate Islam. Because no Jew or Christian can convince a young Islamist who's about to take a radical turn not to go that way. The only hope that there is in reversing the radicalization of young Islamists comes from moderate Islam itself. And that's what we should be nurturing. We shouldn't be alienating these people. We shouldn't be discriminating against these people. It is so incredibly stupid.
I think that's absolutely right. And one might add to it that there's evidence that I and some colleagues have gathered that discrimination by both the police and by the general public has the predictable effect of dampening not just the kind of affirmative action that you've described, but also cooperation with the police in ordinary policing questions that may relate to terrorism. So people are, if they think that the police or the public are more biased, are less willing to come forward with information, are less willing to cooperate in general policing efforts when they concern terrorism, likely out of the fear that they're exposing themselves to negative treatment by the police. It stands to reason that if you believe that either society or the police are more biased, you would be more reticent. You would keep to yourself. You would try to minimize your exposure to harmful interactions. And one of the other interesting findings that I and my colleagues have identified is that it's not just minority groups who have this reaction. It turns out that if you look at the perceptions and responses of the majority groups, so ordinary non-Muslim Americans, if they believe that Muslims or a minority group are being discriminated against, they also cooperate less with law enforcement. So there's a spillover effect from the negative treatment of a minority onto the behavior of the majority. And given the centrality, the pivotalness of cooperation by the public in counterterrorism efforts, right, despite what the government wants, it can't be everywhere all the time. This is an extraordinarily harmful phenomenon. It's something that tangibly creates security losses.
Well, but I take it, though, that this ban, though, to solve a mythical problem that doesn't exist, by banning something that doesn't exist, they actually has a negative effect, and it deprives Muslims of equal access to the law. In your op-ed piece, you mentioned that in terms of, you know, butchers and bakers, etc. Can you explain that to the audience?
So these laws say that a court cannot look to a rule that is sourced in Islamic law. And as your listeners know, there's nothing on the statute books at either the state level or the federal level that does that. So the only instance in which that problem or that possibility might arise is when somebody writes a contract and in the contract refers to Islamic law, refers to Sharia law, and then goes into court to say, please enforce that contract. Well, when does that happen? It happens when people, for example, contract to obtain goods that comply with religious standards. So people enter into contracts to obtain kosher goods. They enter into contracts to obtain halal goods, which are goods that are compliant with Islamic religious law. It arises when people enter into what are called Sharia-compliant finance instruments. These are instruments that are structured so as not to pay interest, because interest is prohibited in Islam. It might happen also if somebody writes a personal instrument, a will or a trust document, that references some Islamic law doctrine. In all of these cases, it is very plausible to read the Oklahoma law and its ilk as directing the court to say, whatever the contracting parties may have written in their document, we cannot enforce these rules, therefore we cannot enforce your contract.
Well, can you imagine, though, anybody in this country seriously trying to ban kosher laws? Or, I mean, it's unbelievable. Can
you imagine any political candidates saying what your Republican pizza vendor said about Muslims with respect to another ethnic group, about African Americans or Jews?
Right.
It's inconceivable.
I wouldn't have a Jew in my cabinet. Right.
And I think quite rightly that person would render themselves ineligible for public office by making a statement of that kind.
Right. Well, he's still out there. This goes right at the, not only is it an insult to America's core values, but it's such an obvious violation of the First Amendment. What's happening in terms of this being challenged? We got a minute.
The Oklahoma law was challenged before it came into effect in federal court. A district court enjoined the application of the law, said that the law could not go into effect. That injunction has been challenged and is now being argued before the federal court for the Tenth Circuit.
Well, I thank you for joining us here and pointing this out to us, Aziz Haque.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Again, I've been speaking with Aziz Haque, who is a professor at the University of Chicago Law School. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the author of Unchecked and Unbalanced: Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. He had an op-ed in Monday's New York Times called Defend Muslims, Defend America. Let's take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the aging nuclear power plants in America that the NRC is, turning a blind eye to or loosening safety standards, believe it or not.
Baby, why don't you give me brand new style? So let me live.